Professor Lorimer Moseley is running three face-to-face courses in North America in 2024. He's visiting Vancouver, San Francisco, and New York City in late September and early October this year. The two-day courses are designed to help you embed the latest in pain science in education in your clinical practice. Check out the show notes to see Professor Moseley's program in each of these three iconic Canadian and US destinations. Yes, you heard correctly, the latest in pain science in education, in person, with Professor Lorimer Moseley, September and October 2024. Hello and welcome to JOSPT Insights, the podcast that aims to help you translate quality research to quality practice. I'm Claire Ardern, the Editor-in-Chief of the Journal of Orthopaedic and Sports Physical Therapy. It's great to have you listening today.
This week on JOSPT Insights, we are here with another Sports Corner series. This time, we're covering men's Aussie rules football, also known as footy, with Nicholas Kane. Nick is a sports and exercise physiotherapist who has completed a master's in sports physiotherapy from La Trobe University. He's also head physiotherapist at the Essendon Football Club, having worked at the club for 9 years. My name is Dan Chapman. I'm a US-based physical therapist and owner of Chapman PT in Baltimore, Maryland.
And I'm Chelsea Kuhman, a physical therapist and athletic trainer at Stanford University Athletics. Nick, thank you for joining us today on JOSPT Insights. We are so excited to hit footy again.
Chelsea, Dan, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We have talked to Mel Haberfield before on the women's side of footy, and she was our intro into footy, which was embarrassing. We should know more, but now we do. But we want to hear your take on, like, you're far more into the men's game. So we want to hear kind of a little bit of how they're different and then get into some other kind of like preseason, since that's where you guys are right now, like how that changes the rehab and all that good stuff. So let's go first into what are the demands of men's footy?
The men's game, they probably run a little bit more. So it's probably vary between 14 and 18 kilometers a game. So I'll let you do the maths on that for miles, high-speed running. So we sort of work out different zones through our high-speed running and mechanics and what they are, but, you know, anything above 6 meters per second, so to speak, we might call high-speed running, and that can vary from anywhere from 500 to, you know, 1,500 meters within a game, which is quite a lot. And then obviously most of the time the players do hit their close to their maximum speed, so that's causing that anywhere from, you know, 90 to 95 maximum speed in a game. So you might get one or two maybe exposures at that level. So preparing the players, ensuring they're ready to be able to hit that is like paramount, as well as, you know, having a good base and chronic load around their 6+ numbers is also really important, that high speed aspect. And then, as Mel alluded to, it is something that, you know, NFL is generally up and back as per rugby. But if you think when I was in the States earlier this year, I referred to AFL as a little bit of a mix between soccer or football soccer and rugby. So that in a sense, it's sort of, you know, how soccer, they kick it back and forward and all around. It's similar to that. We can go any which way. It's on a big oval shape. And then there is the contact element as well. So there's no pads and things like that, as Mel touched on, but there is some really solid hits. And there's different ways to sort of analyze that from a data point of view, you know, using GPS and what have you.
I like that you just brushed over the fact that what was the phrase that you used? Just taking a hit, just no big deal. Just, are you tracking the impact of that with GPS?
We more just use accelerometers. So I guess from accelerometer point of view, acceleration and decels, but obviously that plays a role in, you know, if you are running and your deceleration is, you know, from a contact related injury or contact related hit, different in the sense. So rugby and NFL, it might be one hit, one tackle, and that's the end of the play. And then we'll sort of reset and start again. In Australian rules football, it'll be that tackle and hit, the ball might spill out, and then another player gets it, and two other players are after it. So it doesn't stop unless someone scores a goal. And when someone scores a goal, they get maybe a minute's rest as they reset in the middle of the ground, and then they go again. And the game goes for around 120 minutes, broken into four quarters, and they get like maybe a 5 or 10 minute spell after each quarter. So it's, you know, around two hours of solid work.
I don't know how it hasn't caught on more in the US, because it's just nonstop. It's a lot of fun to watch. Are there differences in injuries here? Like, let's talk about maybe what the most common injuries are. And Mel had mentioned that ACL and concussion are pretty high on the women's field, and then hamstring tears are on the rise too. Is that different with men's?
It is a little bit. We don't have as many ACLs, but on average, we might get one of those a year or close to. Hamstrings are certainly, without doubt, the greatest incidence of injury that we get. So average, I think, across the season for each team is around seven hamstrings or six to seven hamstrings throughout the year. Calf injuries are sort of saying it's probably increased recently over the last 5 years. I think the AFL data suggests anywhere from two to three injuries per season. Hamstrings, calves, from a soft tissue point of view, are certainly there for us. And then outside of that, look, generally probably knees and ankles make up the next step of most games missed. And that's associated with any knee can be contact-related aspects, so meniscal, MCL, LCL, and ACL, of course. But then ankles, again, you tend to get a greater incidence, but they might not miss as many games, but obviously we know some of the secondary things that come with, you know, playing with an ankle that's not as structurally sound. So you're often dealing with some secondary issues around foot and ankle pathology that you carry through the season at times.
You're saying there's more soft tissue stuff in the men's game then? It's more like calves and hamstrings than the ACLs and the concussions?
First and foremost, I'm not an expert on the female data and the injuries and what are coming out too much. So yeah, I can't say exactly like what they're getting, but yeah. From the men's point of view, those injuries I spoke to are certainly the sort of ones we focus on the most, you know, the ones that give us the most grief. And I think, as Mel said, I think they haven't seen too many hamstrings in the last 5 years, but maybe they're seeing a couple more now. And, you know, I think they'll get the odd calf as well.
Okay. So then how do these injuries and the demands that you talked about, how you screen these athletes when they're coming in, I guess, before preseason starts, what does that look like?
I guess where I see the AFL environment can be unique compared to some other teams, say NBA, we have 47 or players on our roster and they are with us full time. So we also then have probably three full-time equivalent physio staff, and we have a rehab staff member and strength and conditioning. Like any sort of injury surveillance, we look at what are the key risk factors for those injuries. So let's use hamstring as an example because it's probably the most prevalent. Greatest risk factor there is probably age and past history. So anyone who really has had a past history of a hamstring, especially in the last couple of years, and is a little bit older, clearly goes into like a risk factor bucket for us. So they might get some extra attention and detail around that without even worrying about anything else. If I touch on, I guess, how you mentioned pre-season, I'll start from the top. Prevention-wise, we are wanting to obviously prevent hamstring injuries. We utilize, I guess, framework of power work is the TRIP framework, which starts with primary prevention, which is we might implement some strategies that across the full group to address a known risk factor. So an example of that is a hamstring injury. Hamstring strength deficit would be a risk factor for hamstring injury along with those other two. So we will obviously get a screen for everyone on a hamstring strength program. And if they are not at the level, then we will prescribe an aspect to get them at the required strength level. And in doing that, however, every single player will be getting an implementation to improve their hamstring strength. That's just what everyone gets. That's universal. And then if you break that down to the second stage, being a bit more selective around those at-risk athletes, they might get something a bit more targeted, a bit more specific. If you're older, had a past history, weak hamstrings, we measure fascicle length as part of our screening and process that. So if they showing they have short fascicles, their program, again, will be tailored towards them to optimize that. I would prevent across the whole group and then how we might break it down. Being able to run fast, regularly, hit high-speed intensities, have good volume and chronic loads, be strong in the gym, eat well, sleep well, you know, and their mental health is in a good place. So they're obviously things that just goes without saying. But then how we break that down from a physio standpoint and identify those things falls under those two bands. That's step one. Step two is the secondary prevention. So secondary prevention comes into the component where we are trying to pick up an injury before it becomes an actual issue or a main injury. So I guess that falls under our screening aspect of what you're talking around there. So every week we will do some monitoring-based stuff from a screening standpoint, which includes a groin squeeze, some hopping on the force plates where we're looking at certain numbers and metrics, and a hamstring isometric pull. And we have a great sports scientist, Josh Ruddy, who pulls together some of that information and puts it on a great display so we can see any change week to week. Second step around secondary prevention also includes a general screen thing that the physiotherapist will do on the table, which is pretty systematic, but looking around some general changes from week to week things, you know, hip range, hamstring length, hip extension length, abduction strength, and some other factors around those sort of typical clinical things that we would do.
Nick, you mentioned checking fascicle length. I am fascinated about what that means. I have no idea. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
So some research was initially done in Australia around measuring the fascicles. That's by sort of Opar and Dave and Ryan Timmins' group at Australian Catholic Uni. It's a measure that they do with an ultrasound probe, and it provides an estimated length of the biceps femoris fascicle length. And some of that research would suggest that, you know, shorter, and I put in quotation marks, shorter fascicle lengths is a risk factor for injury. Longer is a bit protective. They talked around a quadrant of doom in around that paper where it quantifies with hamstring strength and length. So if you are weak in your hamstrings, which was measured on a general Nordic test, and both within the fascicle length, then you're in sort of the bad quadrant where your risk factor is probably heightened. So if I had a player that's sitting down there, they're old, they've had past hamstring issues, I'm clearly needing to address that. But we want them sitting in the area where they're a bit stronger. So for us, it's, you know, 5 times body weight on a Nordic hamstring, and their fascicle length is longer, you know, a measure of around 10.5 to 11. So that's where we work off, you know, utilizing that. We do that at 3 time points across the season. So we just started pre-season, as you mentioned. We'll do it in the next couple of weeks, and then we'll do it sort of leading up to the season, and we'll do it somewhere in the middle of the season. And, you know, it can be transient at times, but we keep an eye on things, and it's not everything for us from a hamstring point of view. It's part of the picture and part of the information along with lots of other things.
Do you see the fascicle length changing over time, or is that just a static measure, like what you got is what you got?
It does change over time. So a lot of the research will suggest that you can get a good change within 2 weeks of a high stimulus. So in order to get greater length across the fascicles, the intervention, the proposed intervention is basically supramaximal eccentric loading. So a lot of the time our management might still be the same. And as I said, our whole team might do that as a primary prevention strategy. However, if I've had a guy who, as I mentioned, past history and is showing up and short back to the lengths, we'll probably curtail their program so they might get an extra dose here and there of some really heavy eccentric over the hip work. So it might be 2 sets of single leg RDL followed by a really super maximal eccentric. So it's down with one, and then we might help them up with the weight and they lower it down again. Or it might be, you know, maybe not as effective, but maybe it's like a 2 up, 1 down hamstring curl. Or there's different any type of strategy you can think that's basically super maximal and eccentric dominant to get that increased length. And you can see some changes over the space of 2 weeks. But yeah, within the research also talks to, you know, high speed running being a good stimulus for increased fascicle length. And, you know, there are counter arguments against the measures that have been done being a, you know, from that research being just a static measure. But at the moment, a research group under Eamon Dallahunt out of Dublin University have potentially more accurate measure of fascicle length. So I'm looking forward to that coming out, which probably factors into the biceps femoris being more of a dynamic muscle that sort of rotates, and it's not so much a static measure.
All these things to look at, but then you can actually kind of like do something about it, right? You have the time to be able to address the type of exercises based on those screens, the type of training you're going to do for them, because you can't do that during the season when they're running around for 120 minutes and then they're going to follow it up with like a heavy eccentric RDL.
Where we're at is the ability in pre-season. You're right. In season, it sometimes can be difficult because you're playing week after week and, you know, you don't really want to play around with hamstring stuff too much when they're going to play 2 days later. So that might be, say, for, you know, if someone's in a rehab block or just small micro-dosing of some bits across the week, typically earlier in the week. But yeah, some other things that we would do at the moment, like we profile everyone's hip strength. So we do some isometric testing on hip extension, hip abduction, hip adduction, hip external rotation, and hip flexion. And what we have to do is then just provide that into a clear snapshot. It's a, like a spider graph. We have targets that we want each athlete at based on their body weight. And if they're not at that level, then we are saying, this is minimum standard. You have to be at this level. So again, you know, we tie that in across the global risk factor. You know, if we're weak around the pelvis, weak around the anterior chain, you know, are we predisposed to maybe picking up more injuries? Maybe we are. Based on, you know, when loads are really high and we're getting sort of energy leaks, so to speak, upon them, you know, dropping at the pelvis or lateral hip control, which strength, calf strength predominantly. So both calf endurance and a seated calf isometric test, which, you know, we want them at least 1.8 times body weight on a seated calf test, which fits with the research from Seth O'Neill, who I know you had on a podcast not long ago talking around calf injuries. We've used that research and we apply it within our profiles as well and make sure that athletes can exert decent sort of amount of strength and endurance within their calves as a protective element, and likewise with hamstrings. Everyone across the group has some intervention around calves, which is the primary, and then other athletes who maybe have had calf injuries or are weak or are having issues, then they might get some really targeted selective stuff that we work closely with them on.
You talked about the 1.8 value for the calf. You look at isometric hip strength as well. What are the norms that you're basing these off? Or what are you looking for, rather, is probably the better question, like in terms of hip strength?
Around the hip, it's a funny one. Certainly, there's research out there around normative values for hip strength and expected for athletes. So some are related to ice hockey. Others are some of the papers within AFL and Aussie rules. But generally speaking, and others are sort of, you know, anecdotal reports. But I guess where we're at with ours at the moment is we have been doing it for a couple of years. So it's an element of pulling that information together from articles and things we've read, as well as just speaking to some people that I value and think are really knowledgeable in around that space and what they see as good measures. And then it's also based on what we've seen a little bit to collate what we think are our values within our club.
And you're relating that to like leg length, or are you just looking for just like specific kind of finding what numbers are going to work best for like positions or something like that?
It's not to position, but and to do, if you were to do it 100% on, especially for abduction, could we do an abduction in sideline into the force frame with it with a long lever? So yeah, I think sometimes the lever length can disadvantage you to a degree, just for ease in where we're at. We do some metrics around incorporating leg length, but where we display it to the players, just keep it as a purely to body weight ratio. So I'm like,
sure.
Look, if they're a little bit disadvantaged, I'm still like, look, I care, but yeah, you still need to be at this number. So just work harder to get there. And it's providing that extra challenge across the time. So, and then, yeah, it is just purely across the group. And as I say, it's a minimum standard. So from there, you might be like, well, this guy is a ruckman. He needs to be stronger at this or that. This guy is really fast. He needs to make sure this and that aspect is at the level. But yeah, if you're looking at, I guess, frankness, you display and get buy-in across the full group, try to simplify it and go over there. So our hip extension is 10 times body weight. We do that over the edge of a plinth at sort of 45 degrees hip angle. Hip AB and AD is 2.5 times body weight, and looking at a ratio of, you know, at least, you know, they should be around 1:1. Some of the research says 1.1:1 AD to abductor ratio. Some external rotation, I think we have 1.75 times body weight, but from there closer to 2 is pretty sound. And then the hip flexion is, yeah, a little bit more than, I think it's around 5 or 6 times body weight we have it at the moment, maybe a tad more.
So it's about at this time in the show, I should probably interject retroactively to clarify a couple points for our American listeners. Our international listeners, please forgive us. Chelsea and I are both red-blooded Americans. And so when we heard 2.5 times body weight, we assumed, you know, someone who's 100 pounds would be kicking out at 250-pound forces, because that's how we generally measure force here when using a handheld dynamometer, which would be an astronomical number. Upon further questioning, we finally understood that Nick is measuring in newtons, which makes no sense to us in America whatsoever, and comparing that to kilograms. So it's 2.5 times body weight, newtons to kilograms. So for our American listeners, just to give some sort of context here, and so if we have a 100-kilogram athlete, that would be a 220-pound athlete for our American listeners, a 100-kilogram athlete kicking out at 2.5 times body weight for side-lying abduction would be 250 newtons. 250 newtons into pound forces is about 56 pound forces, okay? So a much more reasonable number. And so for our international listeners who already understood that from the get-go, thank you for bearing with us while we help our American listeners pick their jaws up off the floor.
Breaking out of the preseason mode, then what we talked again, the demands, the injuries, how are these influencing your rehabs now? What are the key things that you want to pass on to clinicians who are treating footy athletes?
Main thing around injury prevention, we are still going to get injuries, right? And we always want to have this pursuit of perfection within the sports environment. But if we're getting no injuries, we're maybe not working hard enough. So it continues to be a balance of really pushing for performance and training really hard and not being soft and safe, but also then just having strategies underneath that to, you know, make sure we're covering off on those known risk factors and using our secondary prevention to pick up things early. And that comes in line with the player's communication to you around what's happening, wellness, if you're doing that type of thing. So I think it's really important to have a process around, all right, this is an injury, and communicate around injury diagnostics, and then one clear message to the athlete from one person. That's something I'm really strong on. So then the high performance team is really aligned with what we're on, and we're communicating that to the player. I think early on in rehab, from a practical standpoint, let's just, you know, get an athlete moving, getting some, I call it early wins. So, you know, they want to feel like they're doing something and moving. So even if it's just basic movement patterns, or if it's just really some early loading around the tissue, they don't want to sit around and wait, you know, a week or two. They want to feel like they're moving forward and progressing. So I think having that within our process early on is great to start, we get some confidence to make sure we really load the tissue well and to get that to absolute optimal strength and adaptation. So, I mean, across different injuries all look differently, but, you know, what's your measures of how strong they need to be and how robust they need to be across the gym in some things and elements of your testing for a safe return to play. Part of that process throughout the rehab, you are on the field and they are running to similar metrics and hitting those top speeds, the same level and intensity, if not more, and at the cycles, whether that's exposures once or twice a week that they're going to need to do when they're in season. So I think pulling all that together is key. And then once they have returned to play, awesome, you've done well. They've played their first game and got through well. I think it's almost like a different process that starts there for at least the next 4 to 6 weeks, because we know the risk of re-injury is probably heightened in that first couple of months from a return to play. So what's your process and systems from there? So I think that's where some of the monitoring aspects around, you know, that falls in with our screening. So it's whether it's some hamstring strength monitoring, some hamstring length monitoring, that's more just around flexibility and how they're responding from their loads, as well as some of the changes around the hip and pelvis. I think keeping an eye on that. So that might just be a process of having a look over that once or twice a week in the next few months and maintaining some good loading in the gym and really consistent aspects there. So I think once I have returned to play, looking at, again, what are we going to do for the next 4 to 6 weeks to not let anything happen?
For PTs that are listening to this and they want to dive into treating footy athletes or just learn more about treating footy athletes, where would you point them in terms of resources?
And the Sportsnet Network is the leading provider of sports physiotherapy and rehab education here in Australia. And we're sort of moving that abroad a little bit into the UK this year. We actually ran a course for the LA Clippers and LA Kings start in LA earlier this year. What we do at the Sportsnet is run both in-person events, which are still, you know, really beneficial and great for clinicians to network and collaborate with other clinicians and also see presenters live. But we've also have what I think is a tremendous resource to be openly about in the sense of it's a Sportsnet Masterclass platform. So I guess what we've developed now is this platform where we're essentially getting that expert, putting an athlete in front of them and we film them. We make these 60 to 90 minutes interactive and practical based masterclass videos from some of the world's best clinicians. Seth O'Neill is coming, who you guys have on the podcast, along with a number of others from the UK and the likes of Ben Ashworth and Shoulders. And yeah, we have a huge array of videos there. A new masterclass comes out every month. You get all your CPD there in one place. It's a tremendous resource because I think what we do is like some of the great, you know, researchers at JOSPT, I think we're in a great spot where we can help translate some of that research to the clinicians and pass that through faster. We're not trying to review people's work and like put our own biases on it. It is literally grabbing the expert, if it's Claire Adern, and saying, talk about return to play for us. It's there, but it's probably in a bit more of a, you know, visual aspects. I can see the expert assess. I can see, absolutely, see what rehab exercise they're doing rather than trying to picture it in my head. That's what we have there, and encourage people to head over and have a look. And, you know, it's free for a week to just jump on and have a look and see if you like it. But I think the guys who jumped on from the States where we were at the My Institute and really enjoyed that content.
Nick, thank you again for joining us. We are going to throw the link to the Sportsmap Network into the show notes. Also, some links as well to some of the resources, the references that you mentioned during the podcast. There were a lot there, so definitely take the time to go check those out. Nick, thank you so much for coming on the show. And as always, we want to thank all of you for listening to JOSPT Insights.
Thanks for listening to this episode of JOSPT Insights. For more discussion of the issues in musculoskeletal rehabilitation that are relevant to your practice, subscribe to JOSPT Insights on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google, or your favourite podcast app. If you like JOSPT Insights, help others find us. Tell your friends and colleagues and rate and review us. To keep up to date with all the latest JOSPT content, be sure to follow us on Twitter, we're at JOSPT, and Facebook, we're JOSPT Official. Talk with you next time.